Hello, everyone. Welcome to this Adelaide Writers' Week session with Jonathan Leatham. I'd like to acknowledge that we're all gathered here on the beautiful lands of the Kaurna people, and I pay my respects to elders past and present. I'm Sarah Lestrange from The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Any listeners out there, please just put your hand up if you're not. Yes, thank you. That's great. And we're on every week, every Monday, but you can, you know, listen to us all the time because, of course, we're a podcast. Sign up to follow us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you want, really, because we love to bring you wonderful authors and interviews with wonderful authors. It's what we do every week, and this is my first time ever to the Adelaide Writers Week, which is astonishing given the amount of time I've worked at the ABC, and I've had a fabulous time, and it's my last day here, so it's a good one as well. We're not going to be doing audience questions this afternoon, but Jonathan will be doing book signings afterwards. Quite a few of his books are in the book tent, so if you've got a special question for him, save it for then and you can ask him directly. This session is being recorded for broadcast, so please be loud in your appreciation. Yeah, clap. And I am really just so pleased to be here with the American author, Jonathan Leatham. Since 1994, he's published 13 novels, but that's not all. Alongside his science fiction and crime novels, there's also short stories, comics, song lyrics. He writes articles for Harper Magazine, The New Yorker, Rolling Stone. He also teaches creative writing. And look, what can I say? Smashing genres is what he likes to do. He's got this Philip K. Dick speaking to him on one side, and on the other side he's got Raymond Chandler. So, and, you know, he really likes to defy our expectations with genre, and he certainly does that in his latest book. And what you need to know about Jonathan is that he grew up in Brooklyn, New York, on the fabled stoops of those legendary brownstone buildings. And this famous borough of New York has been the focus of two of his best-selling novels, Motherless Brooklyn and The Fortress of Solitude. And in his latest book, with the fabulously titled Brooklyn Crime Novel, he returns to this place of his childhood with an obsessive sensibility. And, you know, even though he said he wouldn't return to this place in his fiction, and this book is like unlike any crime novel you'll ever read. Please welcome Jonathan Leatham.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Jonathan, firstly, what makes a brownstone a brownstone?
Right. What is a brownstone?
Let's create that image for our
audience.
I'm
so obsessed with them, but now I have to account for them. So it's a row house. I mean, I know this word goes attached, fully attached,
yeah,
not semi. they form a facade. You know, they're always individual houses, but they also form these magnificent edifices of brownstones that have cornices all running along the same level, and every one of them has what's called a stoop, which is a staircase with a good platform on it where you can sit at the top. And so, brownstone, some of them are all faced with this kind of mushy brown concrete that hardens into a facade, and some of them are brick-faced but have brownstone just on the windowsills and the cornices, and the stoop is usually made of brownstone as well. So it's a kind of chocolate-colored stone that prevails. And they're sentimentally the house you want to live in Brooklyn.
Well, not just that. You did live in brownstone.
And I did live in
Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Why did your parents move to take you to live in a brownstone in Brooklyn when they did?
Well, so there's a lot to that story. My parents were very typical in the time that they moved to Brooklyn. My father was a painter. They didn't have a tremendous amount of money. He'd actually quit a teaching job. He was a professor, and then he was a carpenter. And they were looking for a lot of space to raise a family and make art and have parties, because they were sort of hippies too, and wanted to live in the city but not be restricted to a small apartment. Spaces that enormous premium in New York City. So what they did, which became a phenomenon, really, was in the very early 60s, they bought a dilapidated brownstone in a neighborhood that had been in many ways declared kind of officially hopeless. It was, in many eyes, slated for demolition. The houses were not, at that point, kind of fabulous and attractive, and, you know, the property value was had fallen into a kind of a crater. And most of the people living in the neighborhood were, unlike themselves, Black, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Cuban, almost anything but white. So they were at the front edge of what you probably all know this term because it's become a famous term, of a gentrification. At the time, however, this phenomenon was still sort of uncovering itself. And it's very typical in a way that it starts with people who are themselves, you know, not that well off. People yeah. who are looking for a very inexpensive place to live.
So they move into this area that's sort of slated for demolition, and they make it pretty again, and then the property estate agents go, oh, I can make some money here, and then it completely changes the fabric of that community. And I guess that's what you've looked at in this latest book, but let's just take a pause before we get to that detail. I mean, and these people were called brownstoners. I love that name because they were hippies.
The brownstoners.
They were hippies yeah. as well. Yeah. But this is the world that you grew up in, and this is the world, I get this sense that there was a certain wildness. Even though you weren't in the wilderness, there was a certain freedom on the street. Was this a wild childhood for you?
Well, I grew up identifying, despite myself, because I grew up in a city and I, you know, went to school, but I identified with the image of the feral child, you know, Mowgli or the Caspar Hauser, you know, the sort of wanderer in a strange landscape. And I think it was because the city, New York City at that time, was so famously in disarray. And this wasn't just true of my neighborhood, although it may have been exemplified in certain ways by my neighborhood. But, you know, the image of New York in the 1970s was of a city that had weirdly kind of lost its grandeur and been partially abandoned. And everyone would sort of shake their heads about the way it had fallen into disrepair, and civic institutions were, everyone was openly cynical about whether the, you know, for instance, the firemen would even show up if you pulled a fire alarm. And at the same time, this has become a very romantic image. I mean, if you think about the punk rock movement and the city that's portrayed in images of the Lower East Side, and there was a kind of cultural magnificence to the wide open, up for grabs atmosphere at that time that people are now extremely, you know, they really cherish it in memory. It's the world of CBGBs and Patti Smith and the Ramones and lots of other things, lots of literature and art, Jean Michel Basquiat, and on from there. Mm-hmm. And so I, of course, as a child, you take the world for granted. I took this kind of urban dystopian romance that I fell into with the city as a natural state. Later, I could frame it, or I could see other people who were older than I was who'd framed it as an idea. For me, it was just an environment.
Yeah, of course, because as a child, you just take what comes. But then you did write about this childhood in your novel, The Fortress of Solitude, this book that came out in 2003. I mean, by this point, you'd written five books before, including Motherless Brooklyn, which featured Brooklyn there. But in The Fortress of Solitude, you know, you describe it as a 600-page book about a block. And there's this fantastic line: gaze long enough into Dean Street, and Dean Street will gaze into you. Do you remember writing that?
I mean, maybe not exactly setting the words down, but I know how pleased I was when I figured out that I could substitute, you know, Nietzsche's abyss for the street I'd grown up.
I mean, what is Dean Street?
Well, so it's my home, and I still can walk down it because it still exists. It's a real place, but it's also become a projection of my fantasies and my desire to understand who I am. So in the novels, I think progressively, one of the things I'm interested in is how you take a place and turn it into a kind of holographic idea about what life should be or how life got the way it is. But it's the center of this neighborhood that I came to feel was, kind of my fate to identify with it, but also identify in opposition to it. Mm. And it was given a name right around that time that my parents arrived there, that people recognize and take for granted, like a lot of things that pre-exist them, called Borum Hill. But I actually knew the woman who made up the name Borum Hill. And so the idea that I wasn't the only one who lived in a fictional neighborhood, but actually we were all sort of living in a fictional construct. It was a collaboration between the idealism of people like my parents, who wanted to live in a real city and live in an integrated neighborhood and have a lot of space and get to know their neighbors, and the projections of the real estate industry, who were very happy to have white people come and help them define an enclave that could be, you know, capitalized upon. So it's a very ambivalent name in a way. It's like home, but I also know it's a kind of a home that services an agenda. And I guess I'm a little bit tormented about that.
Yes, that torment. I can feel it. And I mean, did you feel that torment sort of immediately after writing this book, where you kind of introduced so many more people to this world that was the private domain of your childhood? Suddenly it's there for everyone to see. Did you feel a bit exposed, or did you feel like you'd exposed this place?
There's a sort of weird formation in my relationship to writing about Brooklyn. You know, when I first got the chance to go off to college, I left Brooklyn behind, and I didn't think I ever wanted to live there again. And I certainly didn't think I was going to dedicate myself to writing about it. I wanted to make art, and I wanted eventually figured out that I wanted to write novels, but I wanted to write them about anything but, you know, the street I lived on when I was a child. And I ran away in a really specific and dramatic way. I ran to the West Coast of the United States, lived in Berkeley and Oakland and San Francisco.
As far as you could get away.
Wrote crime novels, wrote science fiction novels, and avoided the subject. It was a footnote, as far as I was concerned, that I was from Brooklyn. And then I made this kind of reversal that surprised and delighted me, where I went back and began living in Brooklyn, and I realized, oh, I could do something with this. And the first thing I did, because I was sort of in a infatuated state of return, I was like, hey, I can walk these streets, and I can write about them, and I can claim them as my own. I wrote this book called Motherless Brooklyn, which is really a total Valentine. It plays it all for, it's the romance of street charisma, street language. It's the kind of thing you see in an early Martin Scorsese movie like Mean Streets, where it's just basically a kind of like, look at how delightfully energetic and chaotic this place is. I love it. It's a total Valentine. So I got that off my chest. I fell back in love with Brooklyn. And then I immediately began to experience what I just identified as the torment of realizing that actually, if I looked inside that box of where I was from, there was all kinds of material that was extremely ambivalent, extremely disturbing, hugely evocative of very, very important ideas to wrestle with about class and race and gentrification. And so then the next thing I did was write The Fortress of Solitude, which was a kind of like, okay, I got the Valentine written, now let's say how how strange, how problematic, how enormous a situation it is to have known this place and come from it. And I thought, then that was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I thought, as you said in your preamble, I thought, okay, good, I took care of that. I'm wiping my hands of it. And I spent another 20 years writing other kinds of books and believing that I discharged my job of saying what it was to be from Brooklyn. Well, the problem
writing
is,
other books set in Queens, so not completely.
I danced around the edges of it. There's a book set in Manhattan, there's a book set in Queens, but there are also several set in California, and I returned to science fiction a bit. I did sort of everything except Brooklyn, because I really was claiming to myself that I'd satisfied the duty of being a prodigal son. I'd gone back and solved the problem. Well, it's ridiculous to ever imagine you've solved a problem as big as your life or as big as a city or capitalism or gentrification. It's just there, and it goes on changing and looking different to you. And I think more than anything else, I circled back in Brooklyn Crime Novel to a kind of renewed attack on the base materials of my childhood, of Brooklyn, and gentrification, just to use an umbrella term for all of the situations and ideas that nest inside that word, gentrification. I came back to do it again, most of all because I'd changed, but Brooklyn had gone on changing too. It was as different 20 years after this book, The Fortress of Solitude, as it had been in the time that I was writing about originally.
Did it surprise you to return, or that you wanted to return in a literary sense? Because you'd never fully left, even though you were on the West Coast. You still sort of were connected to the, what the developers were doing in Brooklyn. Was it a surprise to you? I mean, do you think that's something about getting older?
It snuck up on me. I really refused to do it. I really promised myself I was done. And then as it began to dawn on me that the sensation was sort of one of like, no, come on. I don't have to deal with that again. And then I started to see how much I'd left on the table, but also, as I say, how much was newly apparent in myself. How much, also, it was a language, I think, in the period between these two massive books about that material, the world changed. The language that people used to talk about cities and race and capitalism and gentrification changed enormously. And so I was gifted with a whole new set of operations, tools that I could bring to bear, because other people's response to my own book had enlivened my awareness. And also things nothing to do with me or my book, but just conversations that I was party to, that we're all party to, that have happened. In the United States, we can point to a couple of moments that come, in this 20-year span. Occupy changes the conversation.
So
about
Occupy Wall Street.
You actually fronted
up to Occupy Wall Street and, showed solidarity to the people there.
And then, of course, Black Lives Matter. But also, there was a kind of, this book, Brooklyn Crime Novel, benefits in a strange way from the deep, strange, remorseful, collective memory palace that we all had to construct to survive the quarantine period. Mm. Because I think people were thrown into a state of relation to their own histories by the absence of a social reality. Stay in your house. If you were a child surviving the quarantine, you had one kind of problem. But if you were a 50-something adult, I don't think I was alone in this. I know I wasn't alone in this. Part of what you did in that time was, it was like a force quit on a computer. You did a restart, like, okay, who am I? What does it consist of? What would I want if the world came back? What would I want it to look like?
I think lockdowns were awful. I was in Melbourne, but I do have lockdown to thank for so much great literature that has come out as a result of that. So many authors drawing on that memory palace to, bring us a bit of synthesis and analysis to their lives. And I mean, right now we probably should tell the audience, they're patiently waiting. So what is this book?
Right.
Brooklyn crime novel. As I said, I told you, it's kind of like nothing you've read before. I think of it as a portrait of a place. It's like a place talking back. You will have a different way to describe it because it's, despite its name, it's not a whodunit. It's not a hard-boiled novel. There's no plot. There's characters without names. And it's lots of vignettes drawn together to give us a picture of a place. Why did you happen on this way to write a story of a place where crime is everywhere?
Yeah, it's a strange design. And the title becomes very deeply ironic. And I can tell you, there's sort of a good story about that, which is that when I first announced the intention to go back to writing a Brooklyn story, because those other two books are in some ways the kind of the, for better or worse, really mostly for better, it's an incredible blessing. The books that people associate me with and sort of want to talk to me about the most, it mattered to me and to my publisher and to anyone I'd say it to that I was going to try again. I was going to write about Brooklyn again. But all I knew at first was that I was going to do it again. It was an extremely large intention that was also very sort of oceanic. It was like, let me go throw myself, off the cliff again and see what happens and see if I can swim. Mm. And all I told my publisher was that I would write a Brooklyn novel. But because I have written crime novels and for whatever particular reason, when the contract came back, I said, I don't know the title and I can't tell you anything about it, but it's just going to be a Brooklyn novel. So they sent back a contract. And in the place where the title goes, they'd written the words Brooklyn crime novel. And I was massively irritated at first because I thought,
they're putting you into a pigeonhole.
This is not what I'm going to do. I haven't promised anyone a crime novel. You've reduced my great plan to a mere crime novel, and I thought it was funny, and I thought, well, it doesn't matter. I'll sign the contract because when I think up the title, it'll go in the place of that phrase, and it won't matter that that happens to be there. And then it began to become, in a way, it's like a chip on your shoulder, this thing I was going to contend with or play against, like, oh, you want me to write a crime novel, do you? Because suddenly, it gifted me with a big part of my topic, which was that I felt there was a fundamental criminality to that time and place that pervaded all of our experiences. It was a running joke. People would say, if you said you were from Brooklyn in the 70s, people would say, so have you been mugged? That would be the next question. Of course, they would never say, so are you a mugger? But maybe, that might be the answer, actually. But behind that was some kind of deep, and of course another thing people would assume, they would say, oh, so are there mafia where you live? Well, the answer was actually yes, there were. But those weren't the only crimes. There were others, more nameless ones, more structural ones that were everywhere. And there was also the way the children felt. And I realized, oh, this tells me something about how I felt as a kid. I was both a perpetrator and a victim of crime. To live on the streets in those days was to be involved in crime. So maybe I am writing a Brooklyn crime novel because I'm going to talk about every crime I can think of. So the book became a book that was panoramic. I couldn't stop on any one character or situation. I had to say, okay, here's a crime. Now let's move on. And this velocity, this telling, this inquiry became the center of the project. It's really the voice of the street doing a survey. What crime do we have today? Or, new character, okay, what crime are you involved in? Are you the criminal or the victim? Can you tell me? it was going to be this inquiry. And this drove the entire project. So then, ironically, at the end, I didn't have a title, and I looked back at this phrase and I thought, Brooklyn crime novel.
It was meant to be. And, I mean, you raised that term survey, you're going to do a survey of these crimes, but I read that you actually did do a survey, that there was a questionnaire that you gave to old pals and got them to answer questions like, do you remember the first thing that was stolen from you? Do you remember the first thing that you stole? Yeah. I mean, what was that project about that it you didn't just want it to come from you, like Fortress of Solitude, which was, you know, very much about your own telling. You wanted this to be kind of the voice of the other people who you spent your childhood
anyone
with.
Anyone but me.
Anyone
that
but
was
you.
The goal.
Why
well,
anyone
so
but you?
This was, when I say I didn't know what I was going to do, in a way I had one organizing principle, which is it couldn't be the Fortress of Solitude again. So when I say that I was going to jump off a cliff into an ocean and of the unknown, there was one thing in the horizon, right? I already wrote a book about this. There's the island of the Fortress of Solitude, and I mustn't swim to that island. That's forbidden. I have to go away from it. And so, you know, so this requires that I describe that book a tiny bit. What is the Fortress of Solitude? How did I organize this terrifying, overwhelming material 20 years before? I organized it like Dickens. I did a child's coming of age. The poor little white boy thrust into this world of, you know, the alien and the unknown and the criminal, making his way through Brooklyn. I basically did myself as David Copperfield or Great Expectations. I did the coming of age. And it was a great lens. It's a sturdy, you know, we've seen this novel again and again for a good reason. The coming of age story or the Bildungsroman. I mean, Peter Carey wrote his great one, Oscar and Lucinda, right? This is very, very sturdy, useful genre to use to make a story, especially about a big world or a big city. That's why Dickens is the great writer of London as he sends his little children out there to try to figure it out, right? So I did it by that method once. But I knew that the second time I had to take the little boy who was sort of me completely off the table. And so all this interviewing I did, all this oral history I did, all of this ventriloquism in a way, taking other people's voices and, you know, baking them into the project like, you know, raisins or chocolate chips or poison or whatever they were going to be, but making myself put them in. You know, I was the baker, but these things were going to go in entire, these other voices. That was my way out of myself.
Yeah, and that's why it sort of is this portrait of a place. So there's no central viewpoint, and I guess what you've talked about is the crime, the daily crime, the sense that you are complicit. It could be you doing the mugging or you being mugged, and at the beginning of reading Brooklyn Crime Novel, there's a kind of playful sensibility about that. Like there's this term, mugging money. As it develops, it gets you realize that it's not quite so playful. But what's mugging money?
Yeah, so this was part of the sense that I came from a world where crime had been made so familiar that it was almost hard to explain to other people what this world was like. And one of the features of it, not invented by me by any means, was that the parents would give the children a portion of money each day to go out on the street in order to have it taken away. Mm. It was like going through a toll booth on a highway. And this was so taken for granted that anyone, I mean, for instance, all these schoolmates now in their 50s who I located, if I said to them, did your parents give you mugging money? They almost always said, yes, of course. The question was what amount or how old were you when you stopped having to have it? You know, or if they were, you know, very deprived, they'd say, no, and I was so annoyed that I didn't have any mugging money. I had to give,
so you've got your mugging
I had
money
to give away my real money instead.
Yeah.
It wasn't something people didn't understand. But it's very hard to make people realize outside of Brooklyn in that time and space how bizarre it is. You know, it's like hard for me to grasp how alien this can be in the describing of it to someone else. So there is a playful aspect. I actually think a lot of the experience was translated. A lot of the trauma of living in a place that was so destabilized and so conflictual was translated by everyone into lore, into a kind of a urban legend or folklore on the spot.
And you describe it as a dance.
Yes.
Because a dance is not spoken. There are moves, but it can also be improvised.
You can learn to dance.
And it can change.
And you can teach someone else to dance, but mostly the way you teach someone else to dance is dancing with them.
Yeah.
And that would be a very strange thing to do with street mugging, wouldn't it? You know, like when people ask me, what was it like in those days? And they really pursue it. There are times, and it's quite a strange bodily sensation, when I want to switch register and, you know, put them in a headlock and search their pockets, frisk them, you know, to say, this is what it was like. This is the dance. Do you want to do one?
But it's scary.
It is scary, but it also wasn't scary. And that's the...
Really, it wasn't scary?
The esoteric part of it is that it had a very eerie quality of familiarity and even of a kind of street theater or a kind of folk ritual that was being enacted. And it contained so many different forms of transmissions of meaning, and it was a behavior that could be scary. Mm. It was one of its possibilities, was that it was scary. But it was not the only one.
Yeah. And I guess then there are other situations where this kid takes a skateboard, a new skateboard, out onto the street. I mean, we know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the things that you have to think about.
Yeah, well,
you
so the eternal...
Do I take my new skateboard that I desperately want to show everyone?
The eternal optimism of childhood, right? That we were also trying to be kids. And there were multiple scripts that we were featuring at any one time. And the thing about the street was that it was a negotiation every day. And that's what I wanted to capture in this book, was the sense that you had to invent the terms of your relation to this place. Crime was a feature. Childhood was a given. Play was the desire. Survival was another desire, you know? And that this sense that you were trying to operate an inoperable reality, you know, but why shouldn't a kid have a skateboard?
Mm. Seems reasonable to me. And so that sort of brings us with this, I don't know, this hierarchy of crimes, I guess. We've got the daily dance where you sort of know the rules. You've got your mugging money. It means that you probably won't be roughed up too badly. And then we've got things like, I wasn't sure if this was a crime, and, you know, I'm on stage with you, so I can ask. There's this character called the millionaire, and the millionaire's son refers to his parents as Sparkle and Bunny or something.
Sparkle and Rabbit.
And Rabbit. Anyway, so... Millionaire calls the kids who are swarming around this fire hydrant spray. Once again, this image that we all know from all the movies we've seen and books we've read and, you know, Sesame Street we've watched, this, you know, kids playing around the fire hydrant. And the millionaire calls them animals. And I thought,
right,
is that a crime?
Yeah, is it a crime? I mean, this is the psychic undertow beneath all of these incidents, some of them very amusing, some of them very incomplete or disturbed, but there's this sort of top layer of the river where people are doing things in a neighborhood. Some of them are renovating buildings. Some of them are mugging each other. Some of them are playing dominoes in front of a Puerto Rican social club. Some of them are, you know, calculating how to get men to move out of a rooming house, how to evict them so that they can begin renovating a building. Some of them are just trying to get to school that day. And after this top layer, so colorful, so peculiar, so specific, flows by, and many of these incidents are part of the the roster of crimes, the survey of crimes. Then you have the undertow that the neighborhood's transforming. Different people's attitudes are being navigated and negotiated at levels that are beyond the children's comprehension, but they get glimmers of. And this becomes an argument among different forms of new arriving white families. Are we gentrifiers? And if so, are we glad to be? Or is this a disaster? Are we inflicting damage? Does it matter? Are we in control of the changes in the place we've come to? So this argument, so much of it inchoate, so hard to give name, but it rises to the surface in these extremely uncomfortable, disturbing ways. And that moment when the millionaire, who's not really a millionaire, that's just what the kids think.
The kids think because he's got a slightly nice car. I think it's got an open top.
Yeah, he's got a BMW and he's eccentric and he's doesn't rent out the bottom level of his building, so must be a millionaire. He glances at the black and Puerto Rican kids and uses this word, animals. Just throws it out there, but it's so undigestible to the child who overhears it.
And then, I mean, you're a child in this frame.
Yeah.
Grown up with this, and then you revisit as an adult and you participate in these conversations around gentrification. Where do you see your sense of complicity, I guess?
Yeah. Great question. I mean, complicity, I think, has revealed itself to me over a lifetime's operation. Whether I'm writing about it intentionally or I think I'm just doing something, you know, I'm trying to write a different kind of story or I'm trying to write something entertaining, I write about complicity again and again and again and again. The way in which we find ourselves involved and enmeshed in systems and dynamics of wrongness or imbalance or error, because we're alive, because aliveness contains this feature, feature and a bug, right, called complicity. One of the things I felt, you know, we're talking about this in terms of the children and the adults. When I wrote about when I wrote The Fortress of Solitude, this one that I describe as Dickensian, you know, one of the funny things is I was much closer to being a child back then. I was in my early 30s when I launched that project, and I was childless, and I was carefree, and my joints didn't ache, Yet I wrote a book that I think identifies with the adults quite a lot. And this is something you see actually in Dickens, the Bildungsroman. One of the things it does is the children are very interested in what are the adults feeling. They're trying to figure out the world from that point of view, and it can be quite commiserating. You know, so then 20 years later, my joints do ache. I'm in my 50s. And I start this again. I'm much further from the site of childhood or from the experience of being a child, but maybe partly because I'm a professor, so I have, in a sense, children under my care, and I have a couple of children. And I was quite exhausted with identifying with the parents who thrust us into this crazy atmosphere that I describe in the book. I wanted to write solely from the point of view of the children. And, you know, consistently, relentlessly say in the book, whatever these people were doing to one another in the dance, whatever they were suffering or inflicting or both, however they were trying to navigate this world and sometimes arriving at atrocious decisions, and I arrived at plenty of those myself, we were children. We were, as every child is, we were born into a world we didn't make. You know, and this is not to say that the book is a giant finger-pointing book at all the white families that chose to come to live in that neighborhood. I actually, I've participated in what could be called the early moments of several gentrifications myself subsequently, you know, in San Francisco and Oakland and, you know, even in non-urban spaces, you know, in the American desert. By becoming interested in living in places, I find myself reproducing some of the choices that my parents made. And then what falls on you is complicity. Now you have to really make decisions. How are you going to orient yourself towards the people who pre-exist you in the space where you've come to live? So I don't think that there's a simple feeling to have about my parents and their peers. I think it's bewildering and fascinating, and I try to study it with all its due intricacy. But I do keep reminding the reader in Brooklyn Crime Novel that we were children.
Yes.
We just arrived.
But now with this realization, is that why you go to Occupy Wall Street? Is that why you're part of groups that are trying to defend parts of Brooklyn from development?
Right, okay, great way to put it. Thank you, Sarah. So one of the strange things is that I'm a slow political animal. I have my instincts, but they develop form very, very slowly, maybe partly because I was raised by extremely confident leftists who'd made extreme commitments to movements and sects and ideological stories, and in some cases suffered radical disappointment or disenfranchisement or humiliation even because of the absoluteness of those commitments. And so while I didn't fall very far from the tree, I ended up with a sort of furtiveness, even towards myself. But one of the things that fascinates me, and this is, I guess, a piece of self-congratulation, was that even as a child, when I watched the anti-gentrification people argue with the people who would never, of course, call themselves pro-gentrification, they thought they were revitalization. It was historic preservation. It was neighborhood revitalization. It was anything but gentrification. And I thought, well, I know where I am in this argument, but I also instantly always thought, and I also know that the argument is insufficient to what I'm feeling on the ground. That just taking a quadrant and saying, we're going to protect it, like you just said in your question, let's defend it. Let's not let people have their rent go up over here. Doesn't really, you know, that actually, the only way to satisfy the desire that's aroused by that yearning is on a larger political framework. And then, of course, that does send you towards ideology and to giving capitalism its name and saying, it doesn't just matter over here on Dean Street. It matters over there on Wyckoff Street. It matters over there. Our relation to everyone is being enacted in a kind of miniature. The stakes are miniature. The enactments, the behaviors are all being done in microcosm. But what they beg are the larger questions. How are we to relate to everyone? Mm. How are we to make it right? Well, it's not something I have the answer for. But at least I want to try to make the question bigger.
And you turn up. So we've talked about the framework of this book, Brooklyn Crime Novel. We've talked about how you sort of gathered the threads and, you know, created this polyphonic work. Let's talk about some of the characters in the work, because they're not named, as I mentioned. There's a few characters that have definable names, like C and the brazen head Wheeze.
The Wheeze, yeah.
Never rolls off my tongue. Let's talk about, well, why don't the characters have names?
Yeah, why don't their characters have names? I was, it's a method that I arrived at sort of accidentally with the novel that comes just before this one called The Arrest, which is different in almost every way, But it's often, for me, true that one book teaches you something you need, a tool, or helps you create a tool that you're going to need that's going to be crucial for the next one. And in The Arrest, I was too close to the characters to begin with, and I needed to figure out a way to portray them more in a panorama. Although it's not a big novel, I needed to look at them relationally as a society, it's a small town. And so I started giving them their roles, these sort of honorifics from their roles. You know, instead of giving the butcher a name, everyone just calls them the butcher. Everyone is sort of given their honorific. And this satisfied my need to measure my distance from them and look at them in the round in a way that was incredibly helpful. And so coming into Brooklyn Crime Novel and looking for this displacement, as I said, of the Dickensian style, where everything is sort of sentimentally huge.
Everyone's got a fantastic name.
Yeah. And I've indulged myself with the character names in the past. I like really crazy character names. So in a way, it was a deprivation not to make up a whole bunch of names for this book. But I wanted to use this trick of the honorifics instead and have people understood and in some degree understand themselves according to their roles on the street. Because this was going to be the voice of the street. It was going to be, what does the street think you are? Not what do your parents call you, but what does the street call you? And so people are given either nicknames or honorifics, or they're described in terms of their roles. In childhood, especially as you get older, what are you left with? You remember some of those kids in your environment not by their names anymore, but by what role they had in the system of relations.
Yeah, so there's someone called C, and he's like an ambassador, a solver, an involver. He is a bridge between two worlds. Yeah. What is he, a bridge?
Well, I identify with characters like this very much, who watch and end up feeling both that they develop heightened powers of, what would you call it, mediation. They become ambassadors. They can speak to both sides of otherwise, you know, conflictual realms. But they're also, I mean, talk about complicity, by witnessing and being involved with more than one set of behaviors or value systems, they are hamstrung. They're silenced or made compromised by their multiple affiliation. And C is a black kid on the street who is super great at helping the white kids manage their situation. So he becomes adored, particularly by the parents of the white kids, for being this helper and manager, but also because he seems to speak to the idea of a successful civil rights movement. So if you've told yourself that you brought your white family to a neighborhood in order to live in an integrated place, the day you see your white kid playing with C is the day you're like, okay, I'm vindicated. It's good that I came here. It's all going to be fine. My rhetoric is equaled by my child's, you know, afternoon on the street.
They've chosen wisely. I've taught them well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's the Dean Street Boys, and you're one of them.
Yeah.
Where are the girls?
Well, this is a problem, right? So, you know, one of the things when you try to write about everything, which I have set out a few times to do, is that you're putting yourself in the path of being humbled several different ways. And every project announces what it can and can't do, how big its operation can be. At the outset, you have all kinds of extraordinary desires for its, you know, I never before was so ambitious about how much a book could encompass. I like to think I've written well about women and even little girls specifically in the past, but this book started to be a book about the system of the boys. And I knew it and I denied it, or I thought, I'll get to that soon, or I'll find a way to change it or alter its path. And then it became something where I almost had to make a joke of it. I mean, the girls do arrive, and they sort of make a kind of a petition for their inclusion. And they say they are allowed to sort of almost criticize, like a Greek chorus, the limitations of the book halfway through. But you do have to accept what you can't make a given project do. It's one reason I like to write a lot of books, is that I don't want to believe that any one of them has to do everything, finally.
Yeah.
I want to believe I can handle something else with the next one, you know? And I think of them ultimately like pictures in a gallery. And if you walk through, maybe you'll feel the whole world that I have in my head anyway, once you've looked at all the pictures in the gallery.
So we've got C, we've got the spoiled boy, the slipper, the screamer. Do you love these characters?
Yeah.
Is there love?
The book declares its love at the end. It's not a spoiler. I feel that you really can't write about very much without loving it. I can't. And I talked about the progression of my portrayal of Brooklyn, that first I thrust it aside because of the things that disturbed me about being from that place. And then when I returned to it, I wrote this sort of almost one-dimensional love song, just a total Valentine. But in a way, that's also the truth, is that the source, that declaring that love opened up the willingness to look at everything else. It's like being in a family or anything. Love is the entrance into grasp, knowledge, not just forgiveness, perhaps, or feelings that make you feel sublimely integrated to a thing, but also acceptance of the mystery of the darkness, the willingness to abide with permanent unresolved or conflictual, to absorb dismay into a system of relations. Well, love is the system of relations that can absorb all of those things. So that is how I wrote the book. And I love every character in it unduly.
And you, as this novelist, you've gazed into Dean Street now a number of times.
Yeah.
And it's gazed back at you. And you're an older writer now, and as we do get older, we are looking back at our childhood. Are you still a Dean Street boy, living on the other side of the U.S.?
Yeah, right. So I don't live there now, but I do go back and walk that street. and its mystery is still, you would think that in a way I'm like the one holding this giant flash. I'm trying to illuminate every corner, every seam, every mystery, every ambiguity. But the more of them I compile, the more my amazement at the staggering depths of what reality is and how little our language can surround it. So I think as long as the mystery is there, I'll be a Dean Street boy. Yeah.
And what about nostalgia? I mean, nostalgia can be, kind of be a blur. Whenever I get taken over by nostalgia, I'm kind of rendered frozen, because it's just like this, warm feeling that oozes through me. And I wonder if nostalgia is the enemy of the author, because if you just sit in that place, you've got no problem to write against.
Yeah. But
where does nostalgia fit for you as an author who is revisiting this world of your childhood?
I'm not, nostalgia could be a neutral word in many circumstances. And actually, if my book, for instance, among the things it evokes is a feeling of nostalgia in another person, in a reader, I wouldn't think that they'd made some mistake. But actually, I posited it as a form of enemy to this project. And, you know, some of this is also to do with the role of nostalgia in American life, especially presently, which is there's a lot of nostalgia for imaginary pasts and for non-existent realities. And it's used as a cudgel against some kind of imaginary enemy that is actually just reality or other people. So I'm pretty suspicious of nostalgia. As I configured it for this project, it was another island not to swim to, like my own past book.
And so you wrote this book during the pandemic.
Yes, very much so.
and you were living on the West Coast,
yeah.
Writing about the West Coast. Oh, sorry, getting my...
Yeah, I know,
our coasts. Let me just flip that. Okay, I'll say that again.
Your coasts are confusing.
Yeah. Living on the West Coast, writing about the East Coast. So you're doing this project. And so does that distance help in this project, yeah, where you are going so deep?
I feel that, obviously, there's a push and pull. I have to feel... At times, I have to feel the sensation of that ground beneath my feet, those pavement stones, literally some of the ones I played on as a kid, still there embedded on the sidewalk in Dean Street, under my feet. But I also am a great believer, you know, so there's a quote of Joyce wrote about Dublin when he was living in Paris, right? And he was quoted as saying that the writer's three greatest tools are silence, exile, and cunning. And so I'm not very silent. I don't know. I live in loud ways and talk a lot and listen to the radio and have grown up in homes that were full of other voices. I've not actually needed or bestowed upon myself that much silence. Cunning I can't arrange for. You'll be the judge. But exile has been a tool for me, and it was already. I wrote most of Fortress of Solitude, actually, even though I was sort of living in Brooklyn in those days, the writing was done almost anywhere but in New York City. I was in upstate New York at a writer's colony. I was sneaking away to Toronto in Canada, and I was writing about Brooklyn in this way where I would sort of build a mental diorama of Dean Street and then walk myself through it. And this idea of reconstructing it, the necessities that exile imposes upon you, I really do believe in that tool. So I've written about Brooklyn more not being there than I have being there over the years.
And now I have to ask that most expected of questions. You know what I'm going to say. Are you going to write about Brooklyn again?
Yeah. Well, what I won't do is make the vow that I went around making after the Fortress of Solitude, that I was done, forever done. And in fact, there are some things, I won't call them chapters even, of a novel. There's something I've been writing kind of a little bit stealthily, a little bit furtively, to one side, that's possibly already more about that place, but very different again, with a whole other set of possibilities and restrictions in how it would be done. So I think my prediction is that I will. I'll do it. If I don't, if I live long enough.
Yeah. And I guess that also takes the sting out of the next journalist who wants to ask that question as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's been so wonderful meeting you, Jonathan. Thank you so much for being so expansive and taking to this world, which is so very different from where we are here in the gardens, even though we sort of know it. We don't know it to the extent that you do. It's one thing to see things in movies, another thing to live them. Remember that you can quite a few of Jonathan's books in the book tent. You'll find, of course, Brooklyn Crime Novel, The Fortress of Solitude, The Arrest, which is the one prior to this one, Feral Detective, and Motherless Brooklyn, they're all there. So you can go and get them there, and then Jonathan will happily sign them for you. But now your job is to please thank Jonathan Leatham for joining us today.
Thanks so much.